May it please the court. My name is Michael Pollard, and along with my colleagues William Rapolo and Kyle Olson, we represent the appellant Maritime Life. Following upon in the court's admonition to get right to the heart of it, this is a complicated case. Unfortunately, this one isn't going away. It's been around for 8.5 years. And there are two independent but interrelated issues that are at issue in this appeal. First is whether the district court erred by concluding after the first phase of a bifurcated bench trial that the collateral assignment, which is at issue in this first phase trial, was authentic. The second issue is whether the district court erred in authorizing and directing counsel for a sovereign foreign nation to intervene and take the laboring war in representing the government's interest in this asset forfeiture.
Yep. About that issue,
yes,
it seemed odd to me that the district court allowed that intervention, but I'm not sure what difference it makes at the end of the day, because at the hearing itself, the government participated as the only party opposing your interest, and it just doesn't seem to me that whatever happened before that hearing matters. Why am I wrong about that?
Well, if I may, I'd like to talk about the number of ways that that prejudiced my client. First of all, I think the authenticity determination was impacted by it. But secondly, the government really exceeded.
How was the authenticity?
We put on three witnesses, Ms. Alfonso, whom Judge Huck found to have a very fine demeanor, went to testimony that had been adduced by the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago. It was not addressed during the trial testimony elicited by the United States, and said that her testimony changed. So they used testimony that would not have been elicited had it not been for the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago to undermine her credibility without respect to demeanor. He relied on a deposition also taken by the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago.
It's prior testimony. They could rely on it if it had come from a different proceeding. I don't understand why that makes a difference.
It would not have existed.
The government who's saying that's the evidence the district court should consider once the hearing takes place, right? What if it came from another civil proceeding? They could use it in the same way.
If it was, again, as an admission against interest, I guess. But
if your interest had been represented in the proceeding, which they were, I don't understand. Keep going.
Okay. Well, there's actually another issue.
Other prejudices?
Yeah, they're actually, if I could get through them all. Early in the case, the United States government intended to vacate the order of forfeiture with respect to the Red Road property.
And that was in 2006 or something, wasn't it?
Correct, right. And then the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago objected, and then without explanation, the government files a reply and says, oops, we are going to go through forfeiture. So they changed their fundamental litigation position. Trinidad took the lead in all of the mediation sessions here. We know that Section 853 of Title 21 authorizes the Attorney General to reach compromises in cases like this, not a foreign sovereign. Trinidad insisted.
But it didn't settle.
I'm sorry?
It didn't settle, right?
That's correct.
What difference does it make?
Because had they not been there, it may have.
So the objection here is that the case should have settled.
The objection is that the case should not have gone on 8.5 years. The first phase about authenticity, Trinidad insisted on a forensic document examination of the collateral assignment. The Secret Service went out and conducted that at RTT's request, and it came up with nothing to show any type of inauthenticity. We went out and got an expert. These proceedings were inordinately delayed. 853, you know, intends a much more streamlined type. And in addition,
is Trinidad the victim?
Trinidad is a victim.
And Would it have been, let's say it's error to allow them to intervene, to participate in the pretrial discovery, could they have nevertheless, as the victim, assisted the government as a non-party, non-party victim?
First of all, Section 853 does not contemplate that. 853 has a separate section on depositions, and it says a court may allow depositions upon application of the United States attorney. It says nothing about outside third parties participating. The section on outside third parties...
Assume for the sake of my, for purposes of my question, that it's error to allow them to intervene as a party. Could, though, the government have nevertheless worked with them as a non-party victim to assist them in gathering evidence?
It didn't.
Well, could it have?
If it had addressed conflict issues, if it had sworn them to take an oath of office to defend the Constitution of the United States, something that's pretty odd that you would ask the lawyers for.
Why would a victim have to take an oath to support the Constitution of the United States?
If they're acting on behalf of the United States as a special assistant attorney?
No, they're assisting the government as a victim of crime.
They can't assist as a victim of crime.
Why not?
And participate in the proceedings. They can be a special assistant attorney general and appointed in accordance with those statutes and with the executive office manuals, but none of those things were done. And in fact, the government took a position adverse to its own theory of forfeiture here, which is that Mr. Gutierrez had no right, title, or interest to convey because this document was in the name of Inversione's Rapid Van or because it wasn't recorded. That's the extent to which the government pursued a theory that RTT threw up there, which was inconsistent with its own theory of forfeiture. It cost my client an enormous amount of money to litigate against all these ghosts when it should have been a much more straightforward proceeding between the government and my client. We wouldn't be here 8.5 years later.
And had it been, it could have led to exactly the same result.
Unlikely, because I don't think the government actually would have challenged the authenticity of the document.
You think if we send it back to Judge Huck that he's going to do it any different on remand?
You know what I think, Judge? Well, it depends on what the remedy is that the court provides. But what I think Judge Huck really... I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I'm interested in your answer, but I wanted to throw this in the mix for when you answer.
Sure.
What if we agree with you that Trinidad shouldn't have been allowed to intervene or act as an intervener on the one hand, but we find no clear error in Judge Huck's finding about the agreement itself? We send it back to Judge Huck. His finding about the agreement stays intact. How does it possibly come out any differently? I mean, I know we're not supposed to be primarily concerned with the practical resolution of this, but I can't help but wonder about that. I mean,
okay, I would say in that case it doesn't come out any different, but I do think the authenticity determination should be reversed. Both sides cite U.S. versus Caldwell for what the judge should have done, the prima facie evidence. How the court, in its ultimate judgment and in its oral findings of fact, determined authenticity in this case is, was the collateral assignment executed and delivered in or about July of 2001? That's how he defined authenticity. Now, under U.S. versus Caldwell, we were required to make out a prima facie case. We did that. The court acknowledged, and counsel for the other side has acknowledged, that there was direct evidence that the document was signed, executed, and delivered. The court said this is a fairly close case. It's a difficult case. And under United States versus Caldwell, the case everybody relies on, the panel in that case said this no competent evidence abuse of discretion standard is a cumbersome one to apply. And what the court should look at is, could a reasonable person find some evidence that this was authentic? That's what phase one was about. And in fact, when the government went to stipulate to the admissibility of the collateral assignment, the judge stopped them. Said that would be the end of phase one.
Counsel, let me redirect you back to the intervention argument quickly. If we were to find in your favor in that regard, is it your position that all of the discovery that was taken, because as you contend, might be infused with overlay of conflict, does all that need to be thrown out and retaken by a proper party?
I think all of that has to be, here is my position. This is what we want. Should vacate the, as clearly erroneous or improperly tainted, the finding of authenticity. The case should be remanded. There isn't a lot of clear direction as to what additional remedy the court should impose. We have suggested throwing out the tainted testimony akin to the notion of the fruit of the poisonous tree. There are other things the court could do. The court could have stopped the, but something should relate to phase two. It should be either preclusion of the testimony, maybe barring the government from taking positions inconsistent with their theory of forfeiture, maybe reassigning to a different judge. Judge Huck said he should have he thought about recusing himself.
What did you say in response to that? Did he ask?
We said we would expect you to rule on that, and he didn't.
But you didn't say, please recuse yourself.
We did not go that far.
It's kind of tough to do, I realize, but
it is. It's tough to do, but the court, of course, can do it sua sponte on its own. So I see that I have 3 minutes left in rebuttal. If the court has other questions, maybe I'll address them then. But I hope I addressed what you had in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Pollard. You'll have 3 minutes. Mr. Matzkin. Hold on one moment, Mr.
Sure.
Matzkin. Okay, Mr. Matzkin.
Okay, thank you very much. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Dan Matzkin on behalf of the United States. With me at counsel table is Mark Lester, one of the assistant U.S. attorneys who handled the case in the district court. Trinidad's pre-evidentiary hearing participation in this case, although procedurally unusual, was nevertheless legally proper. And in any event, any error in this case, as Your Honors pointed out, is harmless. And Your Honors, therefore, should affirm the district court. The district court followed the dictates of the governing statute in this case to the letter. Section 853N5 specifically deals with who can participate at the evidentiary hearing and what they can do at the evidentiary hearing. That statute says that the government and the third-party petitioner can participate at that hearing, can put on witnesses, put on testimony, and cross-examine witnesses.
And that's what happened.
That's exactly what happened.
All right. But what permitted the district court to allow Trinidad to intervene in the pre-hearing discovery process?
So I think there's a distinction to be made here. So unlike Maritime, which intervened as a third-party petitioner, asserting an immediate claim to the property here, the district court allowed Trinidad to intervene as a contingent recipient of restitution pending the successful litigation of the forfeiture.
Was that proper?
We believe it was proper. It appears that Trinidad moved under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 24A2. And we believe that Trinidad did meet that standard. And again, this is an unusual case. I don't know of any case law one way or the other dealing with similar facts anywhere. But the
So your contention is then that the forfeiture proceeding was at that point a civil proceeding that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure would have governed.
Correct.
This was intervention as of right?
Correct. And this court, in several opinions, has made clear that Section 853N proceedings are civil in nature. Opinions like Davenport, Peace, P-E-A-S-E, both of which are cited in our brief, and the federal rules of civil procedure would govern here.
Would we have to go as far as saying that Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 24A applies, or would it be enough to say that at the least it could have been permissive intervention under 24B?
I think the latter. I mean, Your Honor certainly could affirm on any basis apparent from the record, and
but the district court didn't really invoke either of those provisions, did it?
Correct. I mean, the district court spoke in terms of, you know, the need for judicial efficiency and judicial economy, but it didn't make clear, admittedly, which provision it was traveling under.
This was not clear to me from your briefs. Today, your position on behalf of the United States is that a victim has a right to intervene in a civil forfeiture proceeding?
Under these particular facts, and again, this is an unusual case. Here, the district court allowed Trinidad and the bank groups to intervene not as victims asserting third-party claims or as, you know, to use Rule 24 as an end run around Section 853N, but for purposes of assisting the government with this litigation.
I understand. Your point is well taken that many times experts, paralegals, academicians, they all assist the United States in civil matters. But what is the provision that would allow such assistance as an attorney absent going through the special assistant United States attorney appointment proceedings?
I don't know that there's a specific provision that governs here one way or the other, but what we do know from looking at the statute that governs these ancillary proceedings, which is Section 853N, Congress explicitly said who can participate at the evidentiary hearing. And again, that's only the government and the petitioner. Now, Sections 853N 1 through 4...
which would seem to suggest that maybe Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 24 really doesn't apply here.
That's certainly possible. I mean, this is a civil proceeding, but whether or not that particular rule...
Well, I mean, if your argument is that the statute provides that only the government, the federal government, could have participated and not Trinidad, doesn't that undercut your argument about Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 24?
No. So Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 24 provides for an independent method of, you know, for intervention. Now, the 853N5 deals only with the evidentiary hearing in this case, and of course Trinidad did not participate in any way, shape, or form at that evidentiary hearing.
Yeah, but that was the whole purpose, right, of the intervention, was to prepare for that evidentiary hearing. Isn't that right?
I mean, the purpose of the intervention from the district court's perspective was to allow Trinidad to assist the government, right?
In preparation for the evidentiary hearing.
Right, among other things, right.
What other things?
I mean, there might not have been an evidentiary
hearing. That's where it was headed, right?
Right. I mean, there were also summary judgment motions filed, so theoretically it may not have gotten that far, but, you know, certainly to a resolution of the ancillary proceeding, I think it would be fair to say.
But an ancillary proceeding where you're saying the statute contemplates only two parties and not Trinidad.
At the evidentiary hearing, correct. But Congress was silent as to what should happen before the evidentiary hearing, and it uses 853N 1 through 4 to lay out how proceedings before the evidentiary hearing should work. And so if Congress had wanted to limit 853N proceedings generally just to the government and the petitioner, it could easily have said so. It would have taken one sentence. I mean, 853N5 is two sentences long in terms of who can participate at the hearing and what they can do there. And Congress didn't do that.
I want to ask you about one of the ways in which your brethren say that they were prejudiced is that, I think I misspoke, I think it was in 2007 instead of 2006, but the government moved to vacate the order of forfeiture.
Right.
And I think the quote from the transcript, it was always, quote, it was always the United States' intent to move for an order vacating the order of forfeiture as to the railroad property in favor of restitution, end quote. And so, and then as I understand the record, Trinidad opposed that motion and the government decided to leave it in the forfeiture context. So how, I mean, it does seem like Trinidad's participation had some impact on maritime. What say you about that?
Right. So I believe, and you know, the assistant U.S. attorney who filed that motion is no longer with the office. But I believe that motion rested on a misunderstanding, and this gets back to the distinction between intervention under 853, raising a claim, a third party claim under 853N in the way that maritime did, versus what the district court did with Trinidad in this case, where, you know, generally when victims try to, raise claims under 853N or to intervene in this case, the government, you know, moves to dismiss because they're not supposed to do that. I mean, they can't, you know, victims can't say, we have an immediate claim to this property. I mean, that's for the government to litigate. And so I think what the AUSA was thinking was that this is what Trinidad was trying to do, when in fact, you know, the reason the district court let Trinidad in was not for that purpose, but for purposes of assisting the government. In any event, any error here would be harmless. And, you know, as you know, the court was discussing earlier.
Well, that wouldn't have been. I mean, if the AUSA, whether he was confused or not, had prevailed in his efforts to end the forfeiture proceeding as to the Red Rock property and make it over to restitution, then, you know, this would be over with, wouldn't it? It would have been over with 11 years ago.
Yeah, again, I mean, I don't know exactly what the motivation was. I mean, I think the motivation...
I'm not asking about the motivation. I'm asking if he had prevailed in his request to the court, which it seems like he would have if Trinidad hadn't been there, then it would be over. So that does demonstrate prejudice, is just my question to you. I mean, do you disagree with that?
I don't know that we can go that far. I mean, I don't know what, I mean, I, you know, truthfully don't know what it was that led the government not to, you know, to vacate that motion. I don't know if it was Trinidad's presence. I don't know if it was something else. I just can't tell you that.
Counsel, let's say the wrinkle down below hypothetically was not that we've got a different foreign nation stepping into the shoes of the United States, but the attorneys acting on their behalf weren't even licensed attorneys and were practicing champerty, so to speak, went ahead and did the depositions. Would it be the United States' position that, well, no harm, no foul, those come in anyway because, after all, the statute dictates United States and claimant in the hearing?
I mean, I think that would, I think if unlicensed attorneys took depositions, I don't know that those depositions would be admissible. I mean,
I'm just trying to explore the confines of your argument that whatever happened during the discovery process won't matter so long as the proper parties show up at the hearing.
Right. And, you know, and in this case, Your Honors don't even need to get that far because, and I would direct Your Honors to docket entry 1270 at page 6. Docket entry 1270 is the district court's oral findings of fact. Before he even starts setting forth his findings of fact, and he's sort of giving a general overview of the case where, you know, he says that the case is a pretty close one, as Maritime says, he also says that he was leaning the other way before the evidentiary hearing. And it was the evidentiary hearing, actually, that was outcome dispositive in the district court's mind. And so from a harmless error perspective, the district court's own words leave no doubt what was decisive in this case, and that was the evidentiary hearing at which the government and only the government put questions to witnesses.
And if you fast forward three pages in the district court's own wording, he references Ms. Alfonso's deposition.
Sure.
That, as I understand, was first chaired by a foreign government, and he bases part of his ultimate decision on his assessment of that discovery piece. Is that correct?
So the district court also makes an alternative finding as to Ms. Alfonso, where he says, you know, even if I took her testimony as credible, it really wouldn't move the needle one way or the other, because all she testified to was that she found a document purporting to be this collateral assignment. Doesn't make it any more likely or not that it was the real thing, the genuine article. And so even if we eliminate that deposition from the equation, we're still at the same end result.
Well, is there any reason to think that had Trinidad not participated, that the pretrial discovery would have turned out any different with just the government doing the work?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And in fact, you know, just thinking this through, you know, how a hypothetical remand would look in this case, I mean, the same depositions will be taken, the same witnesses will be asked, the same questions, substantially the same answers will be presumably adduced. And I probably will be standing at this same lectern in 3-4 years from now arguing the authenticity issue. I mean, it'll be a case of second verse, same as the first. So, you know, any error here, however the court looks at it, would be harmless.
You've got 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I'm happy to address any other questions if Your Honors have them.
No? Is there anything you'd like to add with regard to the authenticity argument?
Sure. You know, the district court had a number of bases on which to, you know, that support its finding of lack of authenticity. The collateral assignment itself had a number of facial problems. It was never recorded. It was never witnessed. It wasn't notarized. The title holder to the Red Road property was not a party to it. It didn't include the legal title, the legal description of the property. It was found, in the district court's own words, willy-nilly in a disorganized storage room.
Let me direct you, though, sure, to the point that your colleague on the other side of the bar makes, and that is that perhaps the district judge skipped a step in analyzing 901.
Right. Well, even if the district court skipped a step, any error along those lines would be harmless because,
at the end of the day, he has to hear all that evidence and decide one way or another whether it's authentic or not. Right?
Exactly. I mean, if Your Honors were to send it back, you know, all the district court would say was, Maritime set forth a prima facie case, but I still don't think that it's the article that it purports to be, and therefore I rule in favor of the government. So.
And it seems like your adversary's argument is, well, he should have said some magic words to begin with, but at the end of the day, would have still made the same determination.
Precisely, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Matzke.
We would ask that Your Honor's affirm in all respects. Thank you very much.
Mr. Pollard, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's remember that the district court entered this intervention order over the objection of the United States Attorney. This isn't anybody here that the United States Attorney sought their assistance. This is over the objection of the United States Attorney. That creates a serious separation of powers issue. The courts don't have the power to invade the authority of the United States Attorney on the issues that it did in this case. That makes it a systemic error, which this court should go out of its way to remedy and make clear. On authenticity, let's be very clear what the court found. Page 1916 of the record. I just find that the collateral assignment did not exist back then. There is no evidence to support that. There is evidence to the contrary. 1917, it's just as likely it could have been placed there by anybody. There is no theory of fabrication. In fact, during the relevant periods of time, Mr. Gutierrez was incarcerated.
Heard witnesses' testimony and discredited them, right?
He chose, for improper reasons unrelated to demeanor, to discredit the testimony of some witnesses and to just disbelieve it. I don't know how he can then say that I find, in a very close case, given direct testimony, that there is no evidence that it exists. So I think that is clearly erroneous. Secondly, with respect to all this stuff about recordation, all this stuff about the property is titled in the name of Inversioni's Rapid Van. That testimony all should have been heard. We defeated summary judgment on the recordation issue because Florida law doesn't look to recordation as the absolute. It's who exercises dominion and control over the property. we put in evidence in summary judgment, which we created a genuine issue of material fact on, there's no dispute that Gutierrez exercised dominion and control over this property. On the title being an Inversiones Rapid event, I mean, to talk about some of the rat holes we were forced to chase in this case, we got a Panamanian expert law. Inversiones Rapid Van is a Panama corporation. Very distinguished fellow from the University of Miami who testifies about Panamanian corporate law looks to bearer shares. The bearer shares determine who owns the property. The bearer shares here were held by an attorney who's Gutierrez. Therefore, Gutierrez is the owner. All of that should have come in. None of it did. And so what the court did when it went to these circumstantial evidence is it looked at things that were not even sufficient to win on the ultimate merits and drew adverse inferences from them. Court can't do that. That was improper and clearly erroneous. And I think the verdict should be reversed and the court enter remanding it and enter appropriate relief that will protect us from some of the parade of horribles that counsel just talked about that will occur in phase two. Thank you very much.
We stand in recess till tomorrow morning.